In the summer of 1924, the residents of Ina, Illinois, were accustomed to a quiet rural lifestyle, one surrounded by Jefferson County farmland, in which nothing much seemed to occur in the way of mystery and intrigue. Residing in the southern portion of the state, and with a population of perhaps no more than 400 residents, Ina didn't even qualify as a small town, and was instead officially known as a village. There wasn't much development in the area, at least not beyond a few shops in town offering groceries and other necessities. And of course, being on the northern outskirts of what has traditionally been considered America's Bible Belt, religion played a strong role in local lifestyles, so the town boasted a Methodist church as well, one led by Reverend Lawrence Height. Height was a married man, but while conducting a service one hot summer day, he was taken by the sight of a younger woman named Elsie Sweeten, a 31-year-old mother of three children who'd been sitting in the first row. The Reverend took the opportunity to give Elsie a subtle wink to express his interest, and she, in turn, responded by putting one hand over her heart to symbolize where his gesture had touched her. Following the service, Reverend Height waited by the doorway and spoke with the attendees as they exited, excited for the opportunity to finally meet Elsie. What followed was a highly secretive affair between the two that summer, one that was very inconvenient given they were both married with children and had significant responsibilities at home that kept them apart. Their desire to be with one another continued to grow, of course, but the circumstances in which they found themselves seemed irreconcilable. Within the confines of the social standards of that day and age, a reverend and a member of his congregation divorcing their respective partners to become a couple was nearly incomprehensible and likely unforgivable. So behind the scenes, the two lovers began to plan their escape. Yet ironically, they weren't going anywhere. It was their spouses instead. One day in mid-July, Elsie went to the local drugstore with her husband Jack to indulge some treats. Today, we generally go to drugstores for medication, but back then, drugstores commonly had ice cream and soda counters that also served candy. It was a great place to get a refreshing drink or have a sundae, and on this afternoon, the couple each had vanilla ice cream and a Coke while purchasing a bag of chocolate candy and some peanuts. On the way home, Jack began to experience pain in his abdomen, something he chalked up to simply consuming too much junk. Later in the day, however, he became quite ill, and Elsie called a doctor to the home, at which point the doctor diagnosed the issue as food poisoning. Over a week later, Jack found himself in critical condition, and with the end seemingly near, Reverend Height was summoned to offer prayer. However, Jack passed away, leaving his wife Elsie a young widow. About 6 weeks later, on September 6, 1924, Reverend Height purchased minced ham for the purpose of making sandwiches for dinner that night. While he was a small man who had actually once worked as a jockey, his wife Anna, to the contrary, was much larger, reportedly about 200 pounds, a size difference that locals claimed kept the couple from appearing in public together, as the Reverend was insecure about his smaller stature. Soon after their meal that night, Anna reported having stomach pains, which led to severe abdominal cramps and vomiting, much like what occurred with Elsie's husband, Jack, though Anna soon became paralyzed from the neck down. She was diagnosed by the same doctor as Jack, and the man concluded once again that the likely cause was food poisoning. Rumors persisted throughout town, however, that the Reverend and Elsie were involved in a secret affair, and at least one townsperson had caught them getting intimate while seated next to one another on a porch. These rumors garnered enough suspicion that the bodies of the dead spouses were exhumed and analyzed, leading to a shocking conclusion that the true cause of death was arsenic, which they'd consumed in their food. While the Reverend was able to kill his wife with a single poisoning, due to the large amount of the minced ham she had consumed, Elsie revealed a much more harrowing story when the two later confessed. She had initially poisoned the chocolate candy she gave her husband Jack in the car on the way home from the drugstore, which made him ill. But when he seemed to be improving days later, she put more arsenic in his oatmeal. When this failed to kill him, she proceeded to poison his tomato soup. Elsie Sweeten received a sentence of 35 years in prison. The Reverend got life. Ironically, the Reverend lamented soon after that the driving force behind the heartless killings were his and Elsie's loveless marriages, which were stated as being devoid of passion. And in the grand tradition of sociopathic projections born of narcissism, he claimed these incidents occurred because he married a cold woman and Elsie married a cold man. Had they married each other, he said, they'd have lived happily ever after. Of course, these violent events were not only shocking due to the horrific antisocial nature of the couple's deadly affair, or even the damage done to the sanctity and integrity of the church through their actions. The worst part, in fact, was the emergence of a lasting stigma about the village of Ina and its inhabitants themselves. In the haunting words of Reverend Height, "I was never a wicked man and committed no great sin until I came to Ina." 6 decades would pass, and for the most part, this story became legend, as those who had been alive to experience the drama had moved on or passed away. And with that, the memories faded, the stigma was gone. Yet, on November 18, 1987, the village of Ina, Illinois, would once again be subjected to being defined by a harrowing incident nobody saw coming. National news that day was dominated by Congress releasing its final report on the Iran-Contra affair, while entertainment news boasted the birthdays of Mickey and Minnie Mouse, and history commemorated the ending of the legendary Battle of the Somme during World War I. But in the tiny village of Ina, with a population still under 500 residents, something occurred that reignited the flames of the terrible past they had laid to rest. This is the story of the Dardenne family murders. It was Wednesday, a day that started like any other, with 29-year-old Keith Dardenne being due to arrive for his shift at work. He was employed at the Rend Lake Water Treatment Facility, and his wife, 30-year-old Elaine, worked at a local office supply store. The couple had a 3-year-old son named Peter, and Elaine was also more than 7 months pregnant with their second child, a girl they had anticipated they would name Casey. The family's house was a spacious mobile home located on the outskirts of an isolated farm, yet it was ironically also set along the edge of a rural highway. So think of the front of the home facing the road near its edge, and the rear facing a field used for farming that backed up to a tree line with woods behind. There were no neighbors within a close proximity. Keith and Elaine had purchased the home in the year prior to this day, but concerns regarding their expanding family, along with rising crime rates, had them strongly considering a move, which led to the house being put up for sale. In the 2 years leading up to this massacre, rural Jefferson County had experienced perhaps 15 murders, a number that might seem insignificant in an urban context, but was astronomical within this region. Keith's paranoia seemed to have manifested in an event that took place shortly before the murders, when a young woman, described as a teen, showed up at the front door of the family's home asking if she could use the phone. While an occurrence like this is a rarity today, in an age of smartphones, it was actually quite common back in the 1980s, as your only option for finding a phone outside the home in a public venue would be a payphone. But payphones were generally not available in places along rural highways unless it was a gas station, convenience store, etc. While Keith was seemingly known as a kind and helpful person, his disposition at that time was apparently one in which his thought process revolved around protecting his family. He didn't want to let a stranger into his home, even if it meant being antisocial in relation to his hospitality. He had a young son and pregnant wife, and viewed himself as their protector. Regardless, what this incident tells us is that Keith was being cautious about who he let into his home and under what pretenses. Unfortunately for him, a predator is going to look for the weak link in his emotional chain and break it. When we want something, and we want it really badly, we are often driven to compromise our ideals in order to achieve the goal. And the weak spot here, both physically in terms of the landscape outside the home and also inside Keith's mind, is the for sale sign they've posted outside, which speaks directly to the family's emotional desires. They want out. But if they want out, the compromise is that they have to let others inside. Now, we'll return to that idea, but in the meantime, Keith has not shown up for work, which is contrary to his stated character of being a reliable employee who has always notified his employer in advance on the occasions that he has had to miss work. Yet on this day, he's a no-call, no-show at the water treatment plant. His supervisor spends the next few hours trying to get a hold of him by calling the family's home, to no avail, at which point the boss decides to contact Keith's parents. After about 5 hours have passed, Keith's father, Don, calls the police in Ina and requests a welfare check at his son's mobile home. The police respond by going there and knocking on the door, but get no answer. Now, the police can generally enter a home during a welfare check, but only under certain circumstances, which would normally involve the existence of a threat or visual or auditory evidence of distress. But none of that exists here. Sure, it's unusual that Elaine isn't answering the door, given that she's supposed to be home at that time with her son Peter, but the police find that Keith's car is not at the residence and everything is quiet. So they ask Don to meet them at the home, as he has permission to enter by default of having been provided with a key by his son at an earlier date. Don arrives with the key, but all parties involved soon realize they won't need it because the back door to the home is unlocked. They announce their arrival upon entering, but it's eerily quiet inside this house. This supposedly occurs around 6:30 p.m., in November, which means it's dark by that time, and we assume the lights are off because there was no answer hours earlier when the sun was still up, leaving us to assume the killings had already occurred. So as the police enter, everything seems normal at first. There are no signs of a struggle or a burglary. However, as they make their way toward the bedrooms, they begin to find significant amounts of blood on the floor. In the master bedroom shared by Keith and Elaine, the cops discover so much blood that it has formed in pools on the floor. Turning their attention to the bed, they see Elaine Dardeen's head above the top of a blanket that has been pulled up over her like she had gone to sleep at night. Her face and skull have been severely damaged, and she's covered in blood, leading to an obvious conclusion that she's been beaten to death. Beyond that, it's clear that she has been gagged in order to keep her quiet. But what's worse is that the blanket that's covered in blood is not just soaked from the top. To the contrary, it seems there is a significant amount of blood seeping upward from underneath, and large bulges beneath the blanket on either side of Elaine tell the same story. Something's under there. They pull the covers back and make a shocking discovery. On one side of Elaine is 3-year-old Peter, who has also succumbed to significant blunt trauma, much of it to his head like his mom, and he's also covered in blood. And just as it seems this scene could not get any more horrifying, it does. There was only one child in this family at the time, as Elaine was still approximately 2 months away from giving birth to their daughter Casey. Yet a premature Casey, weighing no more than 4 pounds at the time, is found lying on the other side of Elaine in the bed. She, too, has been beaten to death. On the floor next to the bed, the police find a bloody baseball bat. Elaine had apparently been beaten so severely that the trauma caused her body to go into labor. While there are instances in which a pregnant woman expels a fetus after death due to the pressure of gases being released during the decomposition process, which is often called a coffin birth, here it seems the premature fetus had evacuated the womb while she was still alive, having been triggered by the mother's compromised survival. It became evident in the aftermath that this child had also been beaten to death outside the mother's body, making this act so evil it's hard to even contemplate what type of person would be capable of perpetrating it. And with that thought, the police are left to confront an obvious conclusion. Keith Dardeen is nowhere to be found. He didn't show up to work. His Plymouth hatchback is not in the driveway. Did he kill his family? The police look everywhere around town and alert other law enforcement elements nearby to keep an eye out for either Keith or his vehicle. But nobody sees him. The cops go to his mother's home with the belief that he might be in hiding there, but there's nothing to suggest he's ever even been there. Back at the mobile home, the police notice the home has not been ransacked and nothing is missing, as jewelry, cash, and technology, such as a new TV and VCR, have been left behind. Elaine and Peter appeared to have been bound with duct tape, gagged, and beaten to death with a baseball bat which belonged to them. It was supposedly a gift from Keith to his son Peter, though I do have to mention this seems a bit odd given the context of Peter being 3 years old. At this age, one would normally find a child with a plastic bat. In those days, it was common for small children to have a short, light plastic bat, almost like a wiffle ball bat, except it had a very wide and bulbous barrel for the purpose of allowing an uncoordinated little person to be more capable of making contact with a pitched ball. Though, it's possible Keith saw the bat as something Peter would grow into over time. So the search for Keith Dardeen would prove fruitless that night, but the next morning, as two deer hunters crossed a wheat field on foot about a mile away from the Dardeen's mobile home, they noticed what seemed to be a person covered in blood lying in the field, undoubtedly deceased. Upon closer inspection, it appeared to be a grown man, later revealed as none other than Keith Dardeen. He had suffered head trauma from some type of beating, but what was worse was that he had been shot twice in the face and a third time elsewhere on the head. Making matters even more horrific was the reality that his penis had actually been severed from his body. Yet his 1981 Plymouth hatchback was nowhere to be found. At least, not yet. Soon after, the car was spotted 11 miles away in a town called Benton, specifically in the parking lot of a bank, which was right next to the police station, leaving many to believe the killer had been taunting the cops. But one thing was for sure. If the police had initially believed Keith Dardeen had murdered his family, that assumption was quickly discarded. Inside the vehicle, they found a significant amount of blood spatter consistent with the gunshot wounds Keith received. However, in order to protect the integrity of the crime scene from false confessions, law enforcement has still not publicly addressed what type of gun was used, nor have they confirmed which seat Keith had been sitting in when he was killed. But for all intents and purposes, it appeared he had been murdered inside the car and subsequently dumped in the wheat field. The medical examiner also concluded that the penis had been severed after his death. Yet there was some controversy, as the Dardeen family's home was located in Jefferson County, and the nearby wheat field, though only a mile away, was located in another, which meant that two medical examiners would be lending their expertise and opinions to reaching a conclusion. They seemed to disagree in terms of the time of death, and also whether Keith had suffered blunt force trauma to his head prior to, or after, being shot. The general consensus seems to be that Keith died within an hour of the rest of his family, whether that means 1 hour before them or after. Now, the police have never really disclosed the extent of physical evidence they collected in this case, but given that it remains unsolved decades later, suggests that there was either little to none available, or it was improperly and/or insufficiently collected. The killer had clearly spent a significant amount of time in both the Dardeen's home and their car, and given that Keith would need to be forcibly removed from the vehicle after death, and the bodies of the mother and children were posed and tucked into bed like they were sleeping, we know there was a good deal of contact between the perpetrator and the family. For the most part, DNA was not used as an evidentiary source back in 1987, and almost certainly would not have been readily available to rural police departments at the time. But that wouldn't preclude evidence collected that year from being tested in subsequent years, unless it had not been preserved effectively. Regardless of the truth, what we can assume with a strong degree of certainty is that nothing ties any one person or persons to this case as suspects by way of physical evidence collected. So, without being able to identify a suspect by way of physical evidence, we're left with the option of profiling one by way of psychological means. With nothing missing from the home, burglary and robbery don't seem to be legitimate motives. A small amount of marijuana, consistent with personal use, was recovered from the house, but neither Keith or his wife, Elaine, tested positive for any type of drugs in their system. In that light, we could probably rule out a drug-related killing, unless a significant amount was taken by the perpetrator when he left. However, it was known that Keith used to take soft drinks to work with him in a cooler, and sell them to his co-workers to make a few extra bucks, which speaks more to him being a straight arrow trying to get by than it does to the presence of drug dealing. Another possibility is that either one or both parents had been involved in some type of extramarital affair, perhaps one involving another married couple, leaving a jealous husband to not only target Keith for murder, but also take revenge and humiliate him by severing his penis. The police were unable to find any evidence of either Elaine or Keith being involved in an affair outside the marriage, and given that they lived in such a small town where everyone would likely gossip and secrets would be hard to keep, it seems probable they found no rumors because nothing of the sort was going on. Yet another possibility that was considered is that Keith owed money for a gambling debt he couldn't pay, as investigators found the scores of a few football games scribbled on a piece of paper. That avenue led nowhere as well, which meant that what had seemed to be a very personal crime driven by a motive of revenge proved otherwise. It was not apparent who could have been so angry with the Dardeen family, or even just Keith, as he seems to be the primary target here. Other questions loomed as well. Why was Keith taken away from the home to be killed and dumped elsewhere, especially since it was only a mile away? Why were the murdered family members in the home, posed as though they were sleeping, even though their heads were caved in and the place was soaked in blood, which would have precluded any type of attempt at disguising the crime scene? Why did the killer make several attempts at cleaning areas of blood in the bedroom, when it would have been more than apparent that the massacre was of a magnitude greater than what would have been possible to sufficiently clean and restore the integrity? How did the killer gain entry into the home in the absence of evidence suggesting he broke in? Was it through the unlocked back door, or did he simply leave that unlocked when he left? Did the family know him and feel comfortable letting him in, unaware of his true intentions? Or did he manipulate them in some way, or even force his way in by gunpoint? And of course, we all desperately want to know why Keith's penis was cut off. It seems so personal. The family at the mobile home was covered and posed as though they were sleeping, which could represent a relationship to them and the presence of remorse. Keith having his penis severed is also highly personal, or so it seems, like maybe he crossed the wrong man by sleeping with someone's wife. But I think what's missing in these considerations is that not all crimes have a direct psychological link to the victims. Quite often, strangers become projections of specific people, relationships, and irreconcilable circumstances from the killer's past. So I think the more intelligent approach here is to examine what the killer did rather than to whom it was done, as projections utilize symbolic relationships rather than personal ones. It's about role-playing, and here the players are specifically defined as mother, father, and their children. Simply put, if you're damaged by childhood wounds and unable to remedy the situation physically because the players involved, including yourself, have either moved on from those relationships, grown, or died, then as a violent criminal, you will likely choose another family to mimic your own situation and subsequently perpetrate the related abuse you suffered. Now, one of the more common scenarios for violent criminals to have experienced as children is physical abuse at the hands of a father figure. However, we also know that the rates of abuse tend to skyrocket when that father figure is not a biological parent. In evolutionary psychology, there's something called the Cinderella effect, which is obviously named for the fairy tale Cinderella, in which a young girl is regularly taunted and oppressed by her stepmother and stepsisters because she is not truly one of them on a biological level. This is something common to nearly all species, and it stems from the idea that we are predisposed to genetic preservation or survival of our own offspring and kin. This is, of course, a principle that began in a world absent civilization ages ago, where predator versus prey was the only way of life, and therefore, with everything being you versus me, or us versus them, when we're talking about packs of animals, there was no room for outsiders. Caring for the young of others taxed resources and made it more difficult to survive and thrive, and there was no genetic benefit in terms of legacy. And in the wild, if the young were either abandoned by a parent or became separated from them, they were then subjected to predatory advances by adults, even within the same species. It's quite common for bears to seek to kill and eat the young of other bears, and because of that, there's a long tradition of mothers with cubs fending off these attempts. Male bears do not remain with the cubs, and so, as single mothers, so to speak, these mama bears have to continually keep aggressive males away until which point the cubs grow to maturity and can fend for themselves. In society, however, regarding human children, the onset of civilization has brought about a mindset in which single mothers can reasonably bring another man into the home around their children, one who is not their father, but will assume that role without any type of genetic correlation to it. And that causes a problem, in the sense that we are still evolving, so while we have many wonderful stepfathers in the world, it's a known fact that homes containing a male authority figure overseeing stepchildren are many times more likely to have abuse present than homes featuring a biological father. children who are not your own still offer the same drawbacks that animals experienced in the wild, with the kids costing resources and taxing the ability to survive and thrive without genetic connection in the form of legacy. Our more evolved selves, or best selves, will forego our primal instincts in these cases and choose love despite the lack of biological factors. However, as a product of continuous evolution, we are also not past the point of feeling connected to those primal traits and can become angered or disillusioned by caring for young that are not our own. In these cases, the stepfather or surrogate father figure can be prone to perpetrating acts of abuse and violence against the children. He preys on them instead of protecting them, as this is symbolic of the act of preserving his own genes as the dominant ones. In truth, it's actually aggression toward the absent father, or the genetics of the absent father, taking the stepfather from feeling inadequate or submissive to a place of dominance. He is, in effect, attempting to dominate the other man's genetic influence, because he has none in this case. So the key theme to take away here is this: absence of the father. And in its most basic essence, that's what the children end up suffering from. They suffer by the hands of the stepfather, or father figure, and due to the biological father's absence. Now, coming full circle to the Dardenne family, what do we notice most prominently about the manner in which this crime has been committed? Keith, the father, has literally been removed from the household and replaced by another man, who is then going to abuse and murder the family members once he's gone. So we could very well assume that this crime might have been committed by a man whose biological father was absent in his childhood and subsequently suffered at the hands of another man due to that absence. Again, let's remember that a violent criminal narrative is intended to express an emotional story that the perpetrator is unable to reconcile. If he is a man who can't accommodate healing by way of things like therapy, having his own family, and becoming a better man than the one who raised him, then his lone source of mending those wounds is physicality. You tell a story in blood. It's just an extremely disturbing version of how anyone else might tell a story in images. If you want to make a movie, you write a script, and then film it in images to manifest emotion in pictures. The same goes here. If a perpetrator's emotional world has a story to tell, then he is going to utilize a script containing scenes that will bring his tale to life in a way that the conclusion reverses the emotional wound he's been suffering. A protagonist in any story is stuck somewhere emotionally, and because of that can't become the person they want or need to be, and proceeds to utilize physical actions that facilitate emotional growth. A killer will do that, but simply utilize physical actions minus the emotional growth, so that at the end, they remain emotionally unchanged due to lack of strength or will, and have simply changed other people physically. What we learn from this is that they can't change, but more importantly, the violent images within these scenes are intended to answer a question. Why? And that's what they want us to know. Not in words, but in images. They want us to know about their irreconcilable emotional pain, and so as our emotional world is mirrored or reversed into physicality back at us when we look through our eyes, in what we call reality, the projection of their emotional world will show us physical pain, specifically physical pain culminating in death, symbolic of the killer's emotional peace, as we find that those who have suffered will suffer no more. So let's think about how this crime might have occurred from the onset. The Dardeen family is at home, and we know that they're already concerned about the crime rate in the area, and Keith has already refused to allow a teen girl into his house to use the phone. There was no sign of a break-in, of course, leading many to speculate that Keith knew the perpetrator. Now, that's possible, but again, let's ask, how do we manipulate other people? We look for the weak link in their emotional chain of defense. When sociopaths and narcissists charm other people at the onset of any relationship, that charm is intended to have the prospective victim put their guard down and become vulnerable, as we don't often advertise our emotional wounds. However, sometimes they are advertised, literally. The Dardeens have a for sale sign outside their mobile home at this time. Unlike today, when listings are online and you set up a showing by contacting the real estate agent through a link or a phone number, the 1980s were a time when face-to-face interactions were far more common. It was normal to put a for sale sign outside the house or on a car in your driveway and have people come knocking at your door. From religious solicitors to people selling makeup to family and friends showing up unannounced, this was an era in which spontaneous face-to-face interactions were a significant part of everyday life. There were no cell phones, no email, no texting, no social media. Life then didn't take place virtually on a screen. To the contrary, it often came right to your doorstep and by way of a surprise. So, let's compare the following emotional transactions. A teenage girl shows up at the house and asks to use the phone. In this case, Keith has nothing to gain or lose by refusing her the ability to come inside and make a call. That means, in this instance, there is no proper risk-to-reward ratio that could suffice in making a decision to allow entry. Now, let's change the context and have a grown man knock on the front door. Keith answers, and the man says he saw the for sale sign and is interested in buying the house, but he wants to know if he can take a look inside. Here, Keith does potentially have something to lose in the form of a buyer. This presents an opportunity in which the risk-to-reward ratio becomes relevant. If he sends this man away, he could lose a prospective buyer. But if he takes the risk, he could potentially be on the precipice of selling the house. Unlike the teen girl at the door asking to use the phone, this interaction garners an emotional investment in relation to deficit. He wants a buyer and doesn't have one. It's an unfulfilled need. In times when we have an emotional deficit, we are more willing to indulge risk that promises to bring balance through a need being met. And yet, when these physical desires of the perpetrator collide head-on with the emotional desires of the victim, just look how irony comes into play to give them what they want, but in the worst way possible. Keith wants to get out of this house. The killer makes it happen. Now, the home is on the edge of a farm, specifically a field, that sits along a rural highway, and so the woods are a good distance away. This means that there is, for the most part, nowhere to hide or truly conceal yourself. The closest place to do that would be the woods behind the home, but since they're at the edge of the field by the road, the woods are somewhat far away. That circumstance leads to a direct approach, not an ambush, and again, it wouldn't be difficult because Keith is quite literally advertising his weakness with the for sale sign. So I would guess that one of the following methods of entry to the home is what occurred. The most direct approach would be for the killer to knock on the door and ask about the home being for sale, specifically if he would be allowed to come in and check it out. But we have to remember he doesn't need Keith to let him in. This isn't an unarmed teen girl. It's a grown man who will prove to be armed with a gun. it doesn't matter if Keith lets him in. He will be able to force his way in regardless. However, we also have to remember that nobody called 911 in this situation, and given that Don Dardine was still able to ring the family later that day, but got no answer, it means their phone was still working at the time, so nobody cut the phone line outside the house, or even in it. It suggests that no one inside the house had an opportunity to call 911 at the onset of the aggression, which leads me to believe Keith let the killer inside the home, at which point the man suddenly drew the gun with the ability to immediately prevent Elaine or Keith from calling the police or another form of help. He also could have pulled the gun on the doorstep as Keith refused to let him in and urged Keith to be quiet and open the door, preventing remaining family members from realizing the truth until it was too late. Now, Keith is going to wind up leaving the home with the killer, and we know from the forensic examination of blood spatter that he was shot inside the car. So we could reasonably assume the killer did not bind and gag Keith at the house like he's about to do to both Elaine and Peter. It would also seem quite difficult to bind and gag mother and child while also keeping Keith at bay with the threat of the firearm. So I would also assume that the killer forced Keith to bind and gag Elaine and Peter while at gunpoint. They were bound with duct tape, but I don't know what was used for gags. I think this act would have taken place inside the bedroom where the family, aside from Keith, was later found dead. So now that the crime is in motion, the pieces are in place to act out the emotionally driven narrative. That means absence of the father is the goal at hand. He needs to leave and not come back, setting the stage for his abusive replacement to arrive. From the few pictures available of this home and property, it was apparent that Keith normally parked the car behind the home near the back door, which aligns with the fact that the police found the back door open when they arrived that night. The killer would have led Keith out the door at gunpoint, and Keith would have reason to comply at this point because his family, while tied up, is still unharmed. There was likely some type of ruse involved here. The killer might have suggested that Keith was simply going to drive him somewhere, or that they were going to a bank or cash machine to get funds, and Keith complied believing that robbery was the motive. Of course, we don't know which car seat Keith had been in when he was shot, but I believe the most sensible choice would be the driver's seat. By sitting in the passenger seat, the killer can focus on holding the victim at gunpoint without the worry of a struggle ensuing, in which he'd be compromised by paying attention to his driving. And conversely, with Keith driving, his hands would be occupied in a way in which, if he fought back, he would lose control of the vehicle. So I think keeping the killer's hands free to aim and operate the weapon while keeping the victim's hands on the wheel is an obviously advantageous choice for the perpetrator to make. But again, we don't know. So the killer forces Keith to drive a short way to the wheat field, specifically 1 mile away, and then tells him to stop, at which point it would be abundantly apparent to Keith that this wasn't a robbery. Arriving at a destination like this suggests one thing: death. And I think that's the reason Keith is murdered in the car. He might have refused to exit the vehicle knowing that his fate was sealed. At this time, he would have been at gunpoint with the killer urging him to get out of the car. I think the refusal possibly could have angered the killer, and before some type of inevitable struggle could take place, the man preempted that event by simply shooting Keith inside the car. We know Keith was turned toward him at the time and looking directly at him, as Keith had been shot twice in the face. A third shot hit him in the head, while he also suffered head trauma we could assume came from a pistol whipping by way of the gun, whether before or after the shots were fired. Either way, the focus on damaging, or attacking the head and what's inside, is directly correlated to the emotional pain the killer suffered in his mind in childhood. A man, some type of father figure, caused him terrible emotional suffering inside his mind, symbolically killing his childhood, and so he reverses or mirrors that idea into physicality through getting revenge on a symbolic father figure by attacking and killing him by way of the head. Now, why does it happen at a farm by way of a wheat field? Well, farms are where things start from a seed, put down roots, sprout, and mature or grow in the same way as a child becoming a man. That seed, of course, in terms of childbirth, comes from a man, specifically through the conduit of a penis. Without the penis, however, there is no way to plant the seed into the fertile ground, so to speak, and therefore nothing will grow. Which speaks to the concept of wishing you were never born, something that is common to people suffering from severe psychological issues. Now, if the father doesn't have a penis, again, he can't transfer his seed to the mother, and therefore there will be no child, which means that the father here, at least in the perpetrator's mind, is being blamed for what happened to him at the hands of an abusive surrogate father figure in the aftermath, because he's the one who started it all. He's the one who planted the seed. He is the biological father responsible for creating the child, and so, if his penis is removed and he is killed, nothing will grow here. That's why they're at the farm. The fertile ground becomes fallow, and therefore the child's suffering won't come to bear. Now that we have the theme of absence of the father present in the narrative, the next step is the introduction of the abusive stepfather, or at least an abusive father figure, coming into the home or the perpetrator's life to replace the father. Of course, what's also important here is that if the symbolic biological father has now been emasculated and killed to prevent the son from existing, then by default of that action, the mother and son must also now cease to exist as well. So obviously, the killer will go back to the mobile home where mother and son are waiting, bound and gagged, and along with the killer satisfying the symbolic narrative of an abusive father figure entering the home in the biological father's absence, he will end their lives to finish the narrative that the severed penis and dead biological father started back in the field where nothing can grow. So the killer gets back into Keith's vehicle and drives to the home, now walking in the man's shoes as the father figure. When an abusive man enters a home as both a father figure to stepchildren and partner to their mother, a situation begins in which he first charms his way inside, and then, as he gains leverage over them both physically and emotionally by way of realizing their vulnerabilities, he unleashes his wrath as a means of controlling them and keeping them stuck in this place. So we know the killer has already arrived and charmed his way inside under false pretenses, and by way of learning the family's vulnerability, which means he will now proceed with his abusive ways. Now, violent criminals resort to physical means because of a concept called disunity between body and mind, which is something caused by past trauma disallowing emotional growth in a way that the adult face you see in the mirror aligns with the emotional growth inside your head. Those who are abused in childhood are often left emotionally stifled by these wounds and remain stuck there, so to speak, on a psychological level, waiting to heal and afraid to move forward, while their physical maturity, which is biologically guaranteed, continues onward into the future, creating an ever-widening gap between the two, that again leads to severe and irreconcilable disunity between body and mind, as they don't possess the emotional capacity to grow up now. So while most of us symbolically kill our childhood by growing emotionally along with the pace of our body's maturity, they become the man-child. With only physical means at their disposal, the only possible reconciliation is one in which they refuse to change themselves emotionally and therefore must change others physically to compensate. Yet because there is no emotional component involved, no solution is found beyond temporary relief, and so it must be repeated, giving us the serial killer. And that's what I see here. This seems to be the work of a serial killer. Okay, so the killer arrives back at the house and steps into the father figure role as the abusive stepfather. The family is bound and gagged, which physically manifests the feeling of being trapped and silenced that mothers and children living with these monsters experience. They are held to an agreement, even sometimes unspoken, that you never reveal the abuse going on inside the house. And as they are normally tied to the abusive father figure's resources, sometimes are stuck in the sense that they can't leave. They have nowhere to go. Other times, that inability to leave is emotional, as the mother involved is a product of an abusive father figure herself in her own childhood and has already been conditioned to desperately keep trying to make the man love her and stop abusing her and the children. Either way, binding and gagging them says they must stay silent and can't get out of this place. And so now, it's time to erase those characters from the narrative, as we talked about, and as a result of previously having removed the biological father. It's intended to make it seem as though they were never born, or never existed, and we'll see a shocking irony appear to show the perpetrator that this narrative will fail to change anything, and therefore must be repeated. Now, disunity between body and mind leads to what I have referred to in many other cases as the redundant bees, or redundant bodies. We have an emotional self and a physical self, and must merge the two in unity to feel whole. The killer has the body of a man and the mind of a child. So as he is unable to utilize his emotional capacity to grow and heal the gap between those two, he will have to do so physically. So let's find our redundant bees. There we go. The killer gets a baseball bat, BB. Now, as the most primal or basic of our evolutionary symbols or shapes are the 1 and 0 of binary coding, or straight line and circle, the man is represented by the straight line, symbolic of a penis, and the woman the circle as the womb. So what the killer wants is to become the straight line, or man, by killing the male child, which not only involves killing that child himself, but also erasing the mother and father who created him. Now, the father is already dead, so what's left to kill is mother and child, or Elaine and Peter. So the killer gets the straight line of the baseball bat and bludgeons them to death, thereby finally erasing all components related to the child being born. He is essentially trying to erase his past, in the same way that you or I might symbolically kill our childhood and move on. But he does not have the emotional capacity to grow, and therefore he substitutes physicality. So we know this is a false narrative based in physicality and derived from symbolic implications rather than emotional growth. So what is the actual truth here that he's denying? Well, the child or killer was actually born, and this narrative has changed nothing. So what happens here? Pregnant Elaine literally gives birth to her child anyway, which enrages the killer because his methods have proven both false and insufficient, showing him that he has not succeeded in his plight. it leads to him beating that child to death to try to ensure that he's won. And of course, he's telling this family his painful story along the way. This is a functional family with a loving biological father, a dedicated mother, and a happy young son who are together and striving to make the best of it. This is what the killer never got, and as he is emotionally stifled, he is unable to express his pain, so it bottles up inside him until it explodes in rage. He wants them to suffer so that they might understand what he endured. It's an extremely tragic and terrifying way of imploring sympathy and empathy. In the end, they lose everything in a physical manner that shows them what the killer lost emotionally. The killer could not go on emotionally after the trauma he endured in childhood, and so, with only physical means at his disposal, he creates a narrative consistent with the family being unable to go on physically. He erases the mother, father, and son, mimicking his own wish that he had never been born, and the universe punishes him with the irony that the baby is still born despite his best efforts to prevent it from happening. Nothing is missing from the home. No cash, no jewelry, no valuables. There's no motive involving adultery, gambling debts, or drug dealing. In that light, we are left with a man satisfying an emotionally driven narrative. In this story, we see Keith dying a horrifying death in which he is emasculated, and the family back at the mobile home suffering in a nearly unspeakable way as well. But let's quickly examine the contrast between the two and the resulting psychological implications. Keith is murdered and dumped outside in the cold, exposed to the elements and alone, while conversely, the mother and children are tucked neatly into bed, with one child on each side of the mother to allow the proximity of touching, and also with a warm blanket pulled up over all of them, as though they were simply sleeping. This speaks volumes to an incredible amount of disdain for a father figure from the past who left, yet an empathetic disposition, even if narcissistic, for the mother and children left behind. So, as this is an unsolved case, the question now becomes, who is he? We can't say for sure, but the name most closely associated with this crime is serial killer Tommy Lynn Sells, often referred to as the Coast to Coast Killer because he roamed the country as a vagrant for the better part of 2 decades and had killed, or at least claimed to have killed, a lot of people along the way. Like most sociopaths, or those suffering from antisocial personality disorder, he had a propensity to tell a lot of tall tales and leave the police baffled as to what the line was between truth and fiction. For some reason, a lot of people believe that if a killer is responsible for a crime, then he is both going to remember exactly how it occurred, down to the last detail, and then also tell the police the total truth in its entirety, which is about as far from reality as one could get in relation to these offenders and the type of mentality they have. We have to remember that many of these men come from abusive backgrounds in which they were lied to, antagonized, gaslit, and abused by authority figures, left hopeless and without control over anything. So when they commit these crimes and gain the interest of law enforcement, they seek to utilize their knowledge for the purpose of leverage and control, leaving the police in a state consistent with what the killer felt as an abused child, which was to constantly hope for closure and healing, but never get it. For some reason, we seek the full emotional truth from men who are absolutely incapable of providing it. They've resorted to crime to cope, with physical means substituted for the necessity of emotional vulnerability, And of course, many of these people are suffering from serious psychological ailments in addition to being substance abusers, which doesn't often lead to having a good memory. Men like Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Tommy Lynn Sells are predisposed to manipulating people in order to control them, and so the concept of coming clean to expose the truth in its entirety is mostly a fantasy. Now, in the case of Sells, many of the lies he told about committing murders were in an effort to escape the justice system in Texas, as a crime he committed in Del Rio, Texas, back on New Year's Eve 1999, led to his arrest, conviction, and death penalty sentence for murdering 13-year-old Katie Harris and attempting to murder 10-year-old Crystal Searles. On that fateful night, Sells broke into a mobile home, sexually assaulted Katie Harris, stabbed her more than a dozen times, and cut her throat. He also slit Crystal's throat before taking off, but miraculously, she survived and got help, later helping to produce a sketch and identify Sells as the killer. In the aftermath, Sells confessed to many murders in an attempt to get out of Texas, but a law preventing death row inmates from leaving was in place. He was executed by way of lethal injection on April 3, 2014, and Crystal Searles was in attendance, along with many others who were hoping to finally get an answer to one question: why? But when Searles was asked if he wanted to make a final statement, he replied with a single word: no. Now, Sells was a drifter, and while nobody was able to place him in Ina, Illinois at the time of the murders, we don't really have a reason that dictates anyone would normally know where he was. He was a loner who hopped trains, hitchhiked, and walked all over the country, never staying in one place for very long, unless it was the rare occasion that he found some type of temporary work. He was a drinker and drug addict, and also known to be psychologically unstable, falling victim to psychosis at various times. Along with those ailments, he was said to have borderline personality disorder, which leads to unstable emotions, impulsivity, fears of abandonment, and issues with identity, among many other afflictions. His biological father, Joe Lovins, a used car salesman, was out of the picture from the start and wanted nothing to do with him or his six other siblings, so here's what happened. He knew a man named William Sells who had incurred large gambling debts that had him in a lot of trouble with some shady characters and agreed to help William pay off these debts. In exchange, William Sells, an insurance salesman, agreed to sign the birth certificates of Joe's kids, which in turn allowed him to repay Joe by adding all of the kids to his company's health insurance plan under the guise of being the biological father. In truth, however, neither man played any type of a role in the children's lives, and ultimately, it was all about one thing: money. One of the men was a used car salesman, and the other wanted money. So let's just look at how the Dardeen family murders narrative ends. We have the symbolic father driving a used car and parking it outside of a bank, and then he disappears. That's what these men did to Tommy Lynn Sells. Now, Tommy had no father around, and his mother, with so many kids, didn't really have the resources or attention span to properly raise him, especially given that she had so many other kids as a single mother with issues of her own. Tommy began to act out and get in a lot of trouble, and was drinking heavily by age 8. Of course, if you understand the nature of kids indulging bad behavior and getting in trouble, it's often a cry for help. They have lives which lack the necessary discipline for proper development, and with nobody caring, they try to force that caring and discipline upon interested parties like parents, teachers, and school administrators in an effort to get the necessary attention they're missing. Yet in Tommy's case, it wasn't working. His mother seemed disinterested. So without the love and attention of his mother, and without a father in the home, Tommy sought a father figure elsewhere. His mother didn't stop him from this pursuit, and by some accounts, even encouraged it. Soon, Tommy, still 8 years old, met a grown man named Willis Clark at a pool hall. Willis took an interest in him, showing him how to play pool, buying him food, and giving him rides to different places, much like a father would do for a son. And with Tommy unable to get his mother's love at home, he saw this man as a suitable father figure, and perhaps the only person in his life who actually cared. But the young boy didn't realize he was being manipulated. When Tommy began to visit Willis Clark's home, and the visits became more frequent without his mother intervening in any way, Willis started to reveal his true intentions. He was a pedophile and took this as an opportunity to molest Tommy, something that went on for years. Tommy's mother seemingly never did anything to put a stop to this abuse, and it isn't difficult to see how her neglect drove her son into the arms of a predator. For all intents and purposes, we could perceive this abuse occurring because she was apathetic about the situation at best, and at worst, complicit, as it is a parent's job to protect the young from predators. What's worse is that Tommy continued to get so bad that when he was 14 years old, his mother packed up the family and moved away without him. She abandoned her son because his behavior had gotten out of control. And now we should be able to see the psychological relevance of preventing the Dardeen mother and siblings from moving away when they put that for sale sign outside the home. He kept them there forever. He takes the father out of the picture and forces mom and the kids to stay. So at age 14, after years of suffering sexual abuse by the hands of a father figure he could no longer bear to indulge, and being abandoned by his mother, he found himself homeless, at which point he became a transient who traveled the country by way of hitchhiking, hopping on freight trains, and begging for food and money. Yet he still didn't have a home, and the older he got and less childlike he appeared, the less he was perceived as someone who should be helped and was more so considered a threat that should be avoided. Having been left out in the cold, so to speak, and without resources, Tommy had to find a way back inside to get what he wanted. So he began burglarizing homes when people weren't around, but that didn't quite satisfy his thirst. He still had to leave those homes and become homeless, so at age 16, this antisocial behavior graduated to invading people's homes for the purpose of murder. He would control the inhabitants and the space and not let people leave, reversing the painful reality of having been abandoned and left homeless. Thematically, he wanted to get back inside and force the occupants to stay. Except the father, of course. So watch it play out in his first murder in July 1979. Tommy breaks into the home of John and Kathleen Cade. He goes into their kitchen and steals a number of food and drink items from their refrigerator and their cabinets. But then he becomes curious about who's inside the house. So he creeps down the hallway and looks into the master bedroom. There he sees John and Kathleen asleep in bed with their 10-year-old son between them. For reasons Tommy could not explain at the time, he took out a .32-caliber pistol and shot John, the father, to death, leaving the mother and child unharmed before fleeing into the night. The sight of that scene was the first time he had been driven to kill. He wanted the father out of the house. However, he allowed the mother and son to remain together in the bed. At this time, he was 16, essentially still a child who needed his mother and had not matured to a point in which he blamed her for the abandonment. He still wanted to be with her. Yet his father had been absent from the start, so he manifested a scene where the father would leave and the mother and son would remain together in the home. It's what he wanted for himself. So, now that we have a psychological profile for Tommy Lynn Sells, let's ask how he ended up in Ina, Illinois. He claims he was aboard a freight train passing through town, and something drew him to this place. What was it? Well, imagine you and I have never been to Ina, spelled I-N-A, and we either look at it on a map, or we're passing through and see a sign. We wouldn't necessarily know the correct pronunciation for this place. I-N-A could either be pronounced Ina or Ina. It's such a small town, only a village, and I'd seriously doubt Sells would have ever heard of it, let alone been there before. So let's ask if the word Ina means anything to him. I would venture to guess it doesn't. But what about the word Ina? Well, in July 1985, about 2 years before the Dardeen family murders, Sells got temporary employment as a carnival worker in Springfield, Missouri. One day while he was working, he noticed a 28-year-old single mother named Ina enjoying the carnival with her 4-year-old son, Rory. Tommy claimed he was invited back to her home for sex, and upon waking in the morning, discovered Ina stealing from his backpack, at which point he proceeded to beat her to death, followed by killing her son, Rory, because he was a witness. However, I would venture to say he was probably not invited. Rather, he broke in and invaded the home. And in the grand tradition of narcissistic projections, instead decided to blame it on the victims. He did the same thing with the Dardeen family, which we'll discuss shortly. Anyhow, one way or another, Sells went to their home that evening and proceeded to beat the single mother Ina and son to death with what item? Her 4-year-old son's baseball bat. Just like happened in Ina with 3-year-old Peter's baseball bat. In both crimes, with Ina and Ina, mother and young son were bludgeoned to death with the little boy's baseball bat. But what is it about these particular names that has triggered him? We see the correlation between Ina and Ina and how they both could have been perceived as Ina, but what's the underlying trigger? Well, it might be that Tommy's mother's name is Nina. Now, what's even crazier is that, given that Tommy was denied his mother's love as a child, which would come in the form of motherly love or platonic love, the severe neglect he suffered left him still attempting to get that love from her as an adult. But by then, childhood is over as a boy becomes a man and is supposed to seek sexually driven romantic attention from a partner who is not his mother. For a short time in his late teens, Tommy was allowed back in Nina's home. Unfortunately, though, since Tommy still could never get his mother's love, an incident occurred when he was about 18 years old, in which he climbed into the bathtub with her and attempted to sexually assault her. Nina called the police and had him arrested, at which point he was made to leave her home permanently. Tommy proceeded to meet a young woman named Cindy, with whom he had a son, but before long, he abandoned the young mother and their boy. So we can once again see rage directed toward getting revenge on his own situation as a child, as he has now caused his son to suffer the same. From his crimes to his personal life, we see various iterations of the same theme involving a young mother and son being abandoned by the father. In some cases, he punishes the mother and son, and in others, the father, while also combining the two in order to take revenge on the whole family. It speaks to pointing fingers in every direction, but never at himself, which is the key focal point of narcissistic and sociopathic behavior by a criminal. That's why, even when they confess, they blame everything on the victims. Tommy Lynn Sells first claimed that he met Keith Dardenne at a truck stop and was invited back to the family's mobile home for dinner. Afterward, he says, Keith asked Tommy to have a threesome with him and his wife Elaine, which set Tommy off because of the sexual abuse he'd suffered as a boy. So he proceeded to beat Keith to death and was forced to kill all the witnesses as well. The second iteration of the story was perhaps more legitimate. Sells claims that he rode a nearby freight train into town and soon after getting off, noticed the for sale sign outside the couple's home along the highway. He says he stalked them from the nearby woods for a while as he learned their habits and exactly who resided in the home, at which point he made his move by going to the door and knocking under the guise of being interested in purchasing the property. There was also another version in which Sells said Keith Dardenne picked him up while he was hitchhiking. Interestingly enough, at one point, Sells told detectives that he had met Keith Dardenne at a pool hall prior to being propositioned for the threesome, which is really interesting because he met his abuser Willis Clark in a pool hall before going back to his home and eventually being molested. So I think this aspect of the confession is a projection of his past trauma, and Sells actually did admit that his abusive past played a role in his crimes. When questioned about his confession to the crime, Sells wasn't specific or accurate enough in a way that convinced the investigators he was responsible. His first attempt to identify which car seat Keith had been in when he was shot turned out to be incorrect. He also failed to recall exactly how the bodies had been posed in the bed inside the mobile home. Yet, Sells was able to describe the interior of the home, something that wasn't made public, and it was one detail in particular that piqued the investigators' interest. Tommy Lynn Sells mentioned that the Dardennes had ceramic ornaments in their home, specifically in the likeness of watermelons. Despite any other inaccuracies or lies throughout this confession, they simply couldn't ignore the fact that he knew this specific detail. The Dardennes did, in fact, have watermelon ceramics, and it was a detail so obscure and specific that they couldn't possibly ignore the implications. It suggested that Tommy Lynn Sells, in fact, had been inside the Dardennes' home, and unless it was in the context of the murders, there was simply no other reasonable explanation for how he'd have access to such information. Did somebody accidentally or even intentionally feed him this information, or at least prod him with clues to an extent he was finally able to guess it? We don't know. But we can say this. Tommy Lynn Sells fits the profile of the killer perfectly. He has confessed to the crime, even if not in a fully convincing fashion. and without an available motive regarding the Dardenne's involvement in any other type of drama that might precipitate explosive violence, a serial killer's wrath seems most likely. Ultimately, we might never know the truth, as it's clear the police didn't have physical evidence to identify the killer. If they did, Sells would have been charged or exonerated through that conduit. Beyond that, there were no witnesses to the crime or its aftermath, as far as I know. If there's one detail that really sticks out to me, however, it's that the killer drove a blood-stained stolen car 11 miles to a bank parking lot next to a police station after the murders. It strongly suggests that even though there might have been an element of taunting the police, the primary purpose for taking that risk was that he had no other reasonable means of transportation at the time. Driving a blood-soaked stolen vehicle that far is exceptionally risky and unnecessary, but if you're a vagrant, it tracks. So in the end, I think what resonates with me about this case is a reality we all face. Someday death will come knocking at our door, an unwelcome guest without an invitation. One that seeks to take away everything we have worked for and everything we care about while lacking remorse. It will come with indifference to our desires and without empathy for who we are. We won't know how or even when, whether it will be today, tomorrow, or perhaps years from now, but it will come. If nothing else, we know that for sure. And it looms over us like a ticking clock, one where we can't see the hands moving, but can feel each click as they move toward our inevitable fate. We do everything we can to try to avoid the end, yet it still arrives. The Dardenne's were a young family, and the parents worked hard to ensure they could bring their children a better future, one full of happiness and hope. Despite that effort, everything was taken away from them in an instant. It isn't fair. It isn't reasonable. And in some ways, the unforgiving mortality we share with them makes us wonder if it's even worth it to put every ounce of your soul into something that is going to be ripped from your arms in a way that you can never get it back. But somehow, that answer is yes. And it's here, in this case, that I think we can finally all understand why. Picture yourself on the other side of that door as the one bringing death. You arrive without hope, without light, without anything of worth to offer. You live in a void of silence and loneliness where nothing can grow. And if you have the courage to think of it that way, it will be apparent that even though the result of answering that death knell means that everything has to end, you've arrived in that place of darkness with a heart full of love.